Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Got science? If not, well, we've got you covered today as we gather our panel of experts in the areas of biology, physics, and chemistry to and geology as well, I might add, to respond to your science-related questions and comments. It's our first monthly science forum of 2012. The number to call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We will get to your call shortly, but first, let's get the introductions squared away, our panel of experts.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist at GE Global Research in Niskayuna.
Ken Wells. I'm a physicist, now retired from the Global Research Center.
And I'm Barbara Brabetz. I'm a biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill.
Allegedly, Ed Stander is around somewhere.
He told me an hour ago he would meet me here.
Okay, so we expect him to come waltzing in at some point. He handles the geology questions. If you could hold off on those until Ed gets here, or not. I mean, we could try them anyway.
Oh, boy.
So what's new, people? Anything going on?
Well, I looked back. I was at our show back in January, Ray. I think you dimly remember that
that's
show.
That's right. I thought we had a show in 2012.
Yes, we have. It was a fine show.
Patrick Don just says we didn't.
Well, Patrick. Sorry, Patrick. Yeah, okay. Anyway,
that's Zach.
That was Zach. Zach was there too. He probably remembers it. Yes, I see him gesticulating. He remembers it as well.
Right.
But we did not have any homework. We did such a good job as scientists that we had no homework, Ray.
That's
right.
So
what does that mean?
Well, we need some tougher questions.
I guess so. We need our audience to call us up with tougher questions.
1-800-348-2551 if you want to stump the band. 1-800-348-2551. Jim, anything going on? It's been a while since you've been on the program.
Yeah, I've kind of warmed the bench.
Yeah. Well, it's good to have you back in a starring
role.
It's
good to be back, yeah.
We finally got that contract squared away, so you're...
Yeah, yeah, and my legions of fan we'll be glad to,
nice.
To hear
Team
me.
Team Pickett.
Yeah.
So, Ken, you've been traveling and doing some stuff?
Just a little bit of traveling, but mostly I'm trying to get out of the house, which is being remodeled. Fortunately, the weather is cooperating with getting me out of the house.
It is beautiful. It is certainly lovely.
I can't believe the wildlife that's out there. The turtles have all come out from their little mud holes, and the frogs are screaming their little heads off. And I've got my perennial... Canada goose couple are already sitting. The mother's already sitting on the nest.
Ooh.
I think this is the fifth year we've had her on the island in the pond in the backyard.
Oh, how lovely!
And he hasn't upgraded his spouse.
I can't tell one from another.
Okay.
The dad has a band on his leg, which I've never looked close enough to see the number on, and the mom has always been just your basic Canada goose.
I'm sure she doesn't appreciate
that comment. We typically have six or seven goslings.
Well, look who's here. It's Ed Stander, who is our resident geologist. You will have to share a mic since you were late.
I heard there were a whole bunch of questions for me, so I had to be here.
That's right. Your punishment is you have to share a microphone with Barbara for this program.
That's okay.
And
she doesn't smell.
Nice to have you here, Ed. Good to have you back on our second show of the year. Yeah. You're on microphone number 5. We usually do this in...
That was me.
You're 5. You're what? 4.
That's 4. That's me.
That's you. Why don't we look on the top of those and see what they say?
The world finally sees what we do when we're off the air.
This is great radio. It's called Setting Headphone Levels. Welcome to the show, everyone. It's Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. Let's go to the phones. Eli in New Hartford. Eli.
Hi, folks.
Hi.
My question... I've read several areas that 97% approximately of climatologists believe that global warming is man-made and that it has the potential to wreak serious consequences. I wonder if you guys have looked into this issue, what your feelings are about it, and if, you know, people in that field are generally correct in their estimation.
Well, in terms of the estimation, there are a lot of different estimations. And I believe, this is Ken speaking, from a physics point of view, I personally believe that there is sufficient data to show that we're going to have global climate change that's man-made. Now, I say climate change instead of saying global warming because while there's probably going to be an overall warming of the Earth's surface, we're going to see a lot more effects from localized changes in weather, whether that's greater sea levels, whether it's the fact that you've got suddenly a greater influx of tornadoes or hurricanes. The basic fact that, from a physics point of view, the basic fact that carbon dioxide can be shown to trap more of the sun's energy, and the more carbon dioxide you have, the more of the sun's energy you trap and refuse to let back out of the earth, is causing us to change the way the climate has been in the previous historic period.
And I would say, from a geologist's point of view, that we've been living in a fool's paradise for the last 10,000 years, because temperature of the earth hasn't changed for more than a degree or two, one way or the other, over that period. And that's why we have farming, and that's why we have civilization and digital watches. And effectively, if you look beyond that, the 10,000 years, the temperature change of the earth on the order of 8 degrees or greater is quite common. So from an anthropomorphic point of view, in terms of our civilization, it's a problem. In terms of the earth, it's something that happens all the time. It's been happening for the last 4.5 billion years.
All right, Eli, thanks a lot.
And that puts it in perspective.
Yeah. Let's go to Michael in Eagle Bridge. Michael.
Yes, I have two questions for you. One's astrology and one is biological. The first one has to do, I live in Eagle Bridge or near Cambridge, which is east of Albany. But every time I look to the western sky, I always see this one single bright light in the sky about 2 o'clock. And I was wondering what that was. I've heard people tell me it's a planet. Some say it's a satellite. I don't know what it is. And the other question I have is biological, is about telomeres. If someone could tell me about those and the importance they have on our DNA and what we learn from them.
All right. Anybody want to take a stab at the light in the sky first?
Yeah, what direction is the light again?
West.
I'm looking
at the west.
Okay. Well, okay. There's Venus in the west right now and also Jupiter,
yep,
which is pretty close to the horizon now. They were very close together a few weeks ago. But Jupiter's been hanging out there in Venus for a couple months, yeah.
And they always appear like a bright white light?
Venus especially, yeah.
Okay, yes, I did see two there a couple nights ago, so that's probably what it was, in Jupiter and Venus.
Jupiter is sort of down and to the left a little bit.
It's a lot dimmer because it's a lot further away. So if you see the two of them and one's dimmer and the brighter one's getting higher in the sky, then it probably is Jupiter and Venus, and it probably isn't a UFO.
Fair enough. All right, let's go to biology and telemarketing. No, telemeters.
Just a little background for the rest of our listeners. Telomeres are part of the cellular structure that's involved in separating your DNA pairs or pairs of pairs when you undergo mitosis. So that's a lot of vocabulary in a science forum. But when a cell divides, say you have an elbow cell, you know, I don't think that's in your book, but and you need to make more elbow cells because your elbow is wearing down and you have to replace it. Your cells will undergo mitosis to replace cells that die through normal cell death or because you slough them off, because you, I don't know, exfoliate, whatever. So now those telomeres have a certain age to them. And it seems that cellular age relates to biological age depending on what species you are, certainly, and that the process of quote-unquote aging has to do with the markers that are left in your telomeres, which really give your cellular age and therefore conglomerately make up your biological age. So what's your question about telomeres, Michael?
Well, I've heard some talk in the past about studies where they're trying to find a way to control that telomere from breaking down, I guess, so that it could somehow control our ability to grow old and not grow old.
Certainly it's a pocket of research. It's very fundamental research at this stage. We look at diseases of advanced aging, not the sense that people are old and getting older, but rather we look at anomalies of aging, populations of people who age prematurely, for example. There's a genetic disorder called progeria, which babies are born, and by the age of two, they show all of the symptoms of middle age. They have heart disease, hardening of the arteries. They start to have osteoarthritis. They lose their hair by the ages of four and five. And very few of them live beyond the age of 12. So that population, we can look at what happens with specifically in their nucleus, what are they lacking and or what do they have too much of, so that we can look at how they're aging so much faster than us, so that we can identify these aging processes similar to what's going on with the telomeres. Certainly, it's a fundamentally new form of research. I won't say light years away, but we're decades away from really understanding and getting a grasp on that particular part of the aging process.
Thank you very much.
Yep, Michael, thank you very much. Let's get one more call in before our first break. Jude in Woodstock. Jude, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling from a cell phone, so I hope it comes through, but I'm wondering
how... It came through fine.
Good. How long it takes for molecules that go past us on the Hudson River to end up somewhere like the Indian Ocean or the North Sea, or does anyone know how long it takes?
In the order of tens of years.
Yeah, that'd be my guess, yeah.
But the circulations, well, actually, the Indian Ocean is going to be, it's going to be a little difficult to get to the Indian Ocean from the Hudson River. But to get from the Hudson River to Europe might be in the order of 5 to 10 years,
I think. Yeah, that's going to be fast.
Okay, slower than that?
It's going to go right on
The Atlantic circulation and the Pacific circulation are general motions of the water that would distribute river water in other places in the world. But how they would cross over into, say, the Indian Ocean, that I certainly don't know. That might take a much longer time. You might actually be more likely to have it get there by evaporation coming down as rain than by traveling in the ocean.
If I had my choice, that's how I'd go, for sure.
Yep.
Air is much faster.
And so here I am. If you wanted that same drop of water to be back in the Hudson, it takes on the order of 30,000 to 80,000 years for it to show up in the same place, the same form.
Interesting.
It's very long.
It's quite a round trip. Jude, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Yep.
Bye.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. We'll take more of your questions coming up.
Support for Vox Pop comes from Steel Engineering and Consulting, Troy, New York. Addressing building problems through engineering investigations and architectural designs. STEELEengineering.com. Joyelle's Jewelers, Del Mar, New York. Specializing in custom jewelry and repair, laser welding, designer jewelry and gifts. Joyelle'sJewelers.com. Curtis Lumber, serving their communities for over 100 years, providing lumber, building materials, doors, windows, paint, and more for 22 locations in New York and northern Vermont. CurtisLumber.com. And Dam Cafe and Deli, Saugerties, New York. Serving breakfast and lunch with chef-created soups, salads, vegetarian options, and homemade desserts. Catering services available, 845-247-0050.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. The telephone number, the scientists are here, you are there. Let's go back to the phones. Doe and Wendell. Doe, you're on.
Hi, I want to know, what's the difference between the solar flare, the sunspots, and does those have anything to do with this unseasonable hot weather?
Well, solar flares come from, sunspots are places on the sun that are a bit cooler than the sun itself. Sun temperature is about 5,800 degrees, and the sunspots are about 3,000. So they look black because they're a lot cooler, but they're actually not black. And sunspots are places where you very often get magnetic signatures. You get an electromagnetic field, effectively, and they can send out the solar flares. So solar flares very often go between one sunspot and the next. So there's a relationship there, but not always. Sometimes they fire off, and sometimes they don't. As far as the heat's concerned, from 1600 to about 1750, there was a period when there were almost no sunspots on the sun, and it was a period called the Little Ice Age. And it appears that sunspots, to some extent, tell you something about how active the sun is and therefore how much heat it produces. During the period after the Little Ice Age, there was a period called medieval warming, and there was more sunspots than usual. Right now, we're in a solar maximum period. Coming up next year is going to be the big one, which is why you have a lot of auroras, for example, and things coming out of the sun. And yeah, it happens every 11 years. And so, yeah, the sun's producing a bit more heat than it normally does, but it sort of averages out. So that's not the major reason for the heat that we're seeing now. It's just it can have a blip, but that's about it.
And I want to point out that there's a slight difference here between how we're talking about solar flares, which happen, that are sort of closed in, go from one sunspot to another, and something called a coronal mass ejection that you may have heard about because we had several of those recently. Coronal mass, coronal, like from a corona.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, not the beer, the sun surface. Coronal mass ejection. It's where the magnetic field suddenly pinches and twists and ejects an enormous amount of charged particles right out of the sun, out of the gravitation of the sun. It keeps traveling out through the solar system. If those happen to be pointed at us, that's what causes the vast majority of your aurora borealis and aurora australis, the auroras that are so beautiful when you do get to see them. And it's one that can knock out communication satellites. It can cause the geostationary satellites to not be able to work properly. It can cause the GPS potentially to not work very well. And in the past, it has caused massive power outages in a lot of the north-south power lines that were in Canada.
We had a CME about two weeks ago, mm-hmm. where there's actually an office, NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, put out a warning that any planes traveling transatlantic or transpacific should not go over the poles. So they should not go over the North Poles because, of course, that's where the center of our magnetic, where our weaknesses are and where people in the actual planes could be exposed to more solar radiation than normal. So they were actually diverting flights from Europe to the United States and vice versa, and they had to take a longer route because of the CMEs.
All right, Doe, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it very much. And, you know, I learned this not too long ago. Pilots in general, if they have a long career, they take quite a bit more radiation than you and I do on the ground.
Yes.
Yep.
Especially with me in my bunker.
Well, of course. 1-800-348-2551. Ed in Salt Point. Ed.
Yes. At the outset, Mr. Stander answered the question on global warming by putting it in a geological time frame of reference. And that made a lot of sense. Either deliberately or not deliberately, he did not, however, address the question as to whether, one, he thought there was climate change coming, and two, whether the man-made factor of that is somehow determinative. And I'd be interested to have him address that directly.
Well, I can tell you one thing that I did just recently. Because solar, this is going back to the last question, sunspots and solar flares, when the sun is more active, it produces more heat, and that can actually affect the environment. One thing I plotted up was the global temperature change that we've been measuring against the amount of sunspot activity we've been having. And it follows almost exactly. Not to say that the sun is producing all the global change that we're seeing, because when you increase carbon dioxide, there is a temperature effect there as well. But we do know, for example, from satellites in space now that the sun has been heating up for the last 20 years at least, and that's going to be a major effect. Another major effect is the clearness of the atmosphere. During the 1980s, 1970s, whenever there was a lunar eclipse, the moon disappeared because light passing through the Earth's atmosphere wouldn't get refracted from the atmosphere and wouldn't brighten up the moon. So actually the moon would turn dark. In the last couple of years, the light coming through the atmosphere would wind up making the moon turn red because it's going through more of our atmosphere and it's not getting stopped. So the atmosphere is much cleaner than it's been for a number of years. And that is also heating up the Earth. So there are a number of things that are involved. And the problem is trying to say which ones are the most important. That's really where the question is. What the fact that the Earth is heating up, we're pretty sure about that. But how much effect the man-made heating has with its 100 parts per million of CO2? That's a very good question, and I can't answer that.
Well, certainly.
I understand that answer. But my question was, just to put it back in the original frame, whether the number is 97% or whatever, a whole lot of scientists have taken the leap and have said that they think the man-made contribution, nobody doubts that there are other contributions, but they've said that the man-made contribution is something that is in some sense a tipping factor, and that's why we should take steps to mitigate that. And I'm asking you whether you are still skeptical about that because you're, you know, more focused on the other factors and you think they've taken too much of a leap. That's my question.
All right, Ed, thank you.
Well, I'll put two things in there. The first is, in terms of a tipping point, it's a very good question what the tipping point might be and therefore what effect the amount of CO2 we're putting in the atmosphere actually has. The second part, and I am skeptical in a certain sense, in that there have been an awful lot of times in science where people jump on a bandwagon and later on are proven wrong. And because I can't say how much effect the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is going to have in the long term, I have a problem with that in general. Just as an example, during the last power outage out in the Midwest, they did some studies and determined that the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere dropped precipitously right after that, simply because a lot of the CO2 was going into the water supply. The oceans clean up CO2 rather relatively fast. They flew with helicopters and measured by COSPEC the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, and it decreased radically. So how much of an effect it is, how much of an effect it has in the future, I really can't say. I'm still skeptical.
All right, Ed, we got to move on, but we'll let our other scientists take a crack here.
Yeah, I think, well, it's brought up another very important point about the CO2 and that ending up in the oceans, that it's changing the chemistry of the oceans.
Certainly.
The pH is going down and that's affecting the way that
Has there been measurable effects in seashells?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we can use seashells actually as kind of rings on a tree to look back in sediments to also be able to interpret how concentrated the CO2 was in the atmosphere and then ultimately in the ocean by looking at how thin or how thick the diatoms shells have been in the past. So we can measure it and we see that it is dropping.
All right. So
it's not just about temperature.
Let's go over to Jeff in Egremont. Jeff, you're on.
Yes, hi.
Hi. Uh-oh. Are you gone? Well, short and sweet. Let's go to Jack in Middletown. Jack.
Hi. I got two quick questions. First one is with respect to planes flying over the poles. I heard one time that part of the reason why the commercial flights were restricted was because of the jet wash falling down onto the poles and melting that. And I wonder if that's accurate or not. And what about the jet wash that falls everywhere over every city?
I see a lot of head shaking in here.
No, the answer is no. It has to do with gamma ray exposure.
Okay, but what about the jet wash in general? Does that fall down to the earth?
You mean the carbon dioxide in the water that's made when it's combusted?
Well, whatever the exhaust that you could see, you know, the colloidal dispersion or whatever it is coming out of a plane, you know, when they fly across the sky?
It's carbon dioxide in water.
Okay. Does that fall down to the earth?
No. If you watch a vapor trail, 90% of the time that you see a vapor trail, it disappears just a few degrees behind the airplane that you see. Sometimes when the conditions are right and at the altitude the plane's at, you will see it actually cause a cloud to form. But the majority of them just disappear very quickly.
Yeah, and the gases just get mixed in the atmosphere.
All right, sorry, that question took a lot longer than I thought. really quick, with plate tectonics, and my knowledge is that there's different plates that either submerge or converge or subduct and whatnot. Plates go underneath each other and turn back into magma. Is that accurate? Plates can go underneath another one back into liquid form?
Yeah, the surface of the Earth's made of two types of plates, continental plates and ocean plates. And ocean material is a lot heavier than continental material, so it tends to go down the tubes when it gets heavy enough, while the continental material stays at the surface. So, yes. Yeah, go on.
The stuff that goes underneath, does that disappear entirely? Because my question would be whether fossils or artifacts and whatnot could ever be lost underneath those plates and just gone without any record. Erased from history. Is that possible?
Oh, yeah. Not only that, but, for example, seamounts that are on the ocean floor sometimes get scraped off and stuck onto the continents. So Atlantis may be someplace over by Vancouver. These are all possible.
Now you see what I'm getting at.
Yeah. All right. Jack, thanks a lot. Very interesting calls today. 800-348-2551. One open line at the moment, 1-800-348-2551. We go to Mark in... No, we don't go to... Mark, is this Mark?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yes, it is Mark. There you are. Your sheet is back up.
I'm sorry. The call dropped. I called back. You fixed right up. I'm sorry. Love your show. Good afternoon, everybody.
Hi.
I had a question about the two stars that have been in the sky for about the last week, and they're getting farther and farther apart as days go on. But do you know the ones I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, they're not stars.
Yep, they're planets. The brighter, higher one right now is Venus.
Okay.
And the lower, dimmer one is Jupiter.
Now, I look at the sky almost every night, and I don't remember ever seeing these stars together like this. Is this something new?
Yeah, it should be every 10 years.
It happens every so often, yeah.
It's been 10 years. All right, so.
They were very close. They were very close a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, yep. And before somebody asks, if you go in the other direction, you'll see Mars, which is red.
High in the sky.
Yep, and then Saturn will be coming up.
Coming up soon.
Pretty soon.
We had a very comical time with the family over the weekend. We have a fairly modest telescope, and I said, all right, we're going to break it out. We'll look at Jupiter. Try it. Well, Dad had a bit of a problem sighting the scope, and it... took about an hour and a half, and all the kids went to bed, and I swore a lot. It was fun. Jeff in Egremont, you're back. Jeff.
Hi, my name is Jeff. I'm calling with regard to string theory, and I'm wondering, these little strings of energy, do they dissipate over time? Are they regenerated? What happens to these strings? Are they there forever, or what? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, strings are pretty hypothetical, actually, but they are thought to be the fundamental thing which makes up matter. So they stick around.
So which generation of fundamental thing is this?
I don't know.
At one point, we decided that there were four elements, earth, wind, fire.
So I guess this is probably about six levels down.
Well, there were the atoms, and then there were the electrons and protons and neutrons, and then there were the quarks, and now the quarks are made of strings.
So you're a little skeptical
then,
eh? Ray
is looking at us like we're crazy. An interior science joke,
I think this is some cutting physicist observations here. Go ahead.
It's just a case of you always think, in physics, you always think you're at the leading edge. Well, I don't think you ever are.
There is certainly controversy about string theory in that how do you actually go about testing it? As a physicist, what do you say about string theory?
I have to say that they've advanced string theory far beyond my comprehension of it. So I have almost a layperson's comprehension of it, and I have to say I believe it's got some interesting math that can be made to fit the facts by sort of forcing it.
Okay.
And we haven't really come up with a prediction yet where we can say, okay, I predict that when you do this experiment in the Large Hadron Collider or wherever you're going to do it, that you'll see these results, which I can predict only because I'm using the math from string theory, and it cannot be predicted by general relativity special relativity or conventional Newtonian mechanics or anything like that. And if they did that experiment and they found, yes, they had results that agreed with your predictions, that would lend real credence to string theory, and it would no longer be string theory. It'd be string fact.
It would still be string theory.
It'd be rope theory.
Yeah. I mean, Einstein would be appalled, actually, I think, by string theory because... until very recently, physicists pretty much focused on what could be measured or what could be potentially measured, the testable hypotheses. And string theory, I think, has taken on sort of a life of its own and has delved, as Ken said, into the mathematics of it and has really yet to generate a testable hypothesis, as far as I know.
Is this common in science for a theory that has been around now for quite a while to last this long and have legs without ever having anything that could be even testable?
I don't think so.
No, never. I really don't think so.
No.
It's always been testable.
Interesting.
But it's on the edge.
Okay.
And so you leave it there on the table, and you wait until something comes along that makes sense with it, and then you start looking into it again.
All right. Yeah.
There were predictions of atoms long before we could pick out individual atoms experimentally and predictably. And we're talking many decades here. So, no, I don't think
many
this
decades.
Is many decades.
You mean when they discovered atoms?
No, when they predicted atoms.
Sorry.
And they had an experiment that could produce them. So the string theory could be right, but we don't know.
But that's not using the scientific method, because the scientific method requires a testable hypothesis. It's a theory, it's a thought, it's a surmise, it's a conjecture, but it's math.
Okay, but the statement was, has string theory been around too long still as a theory, or still as a hypothesis for it to have legs? Okay, so, and I say, no, it hasn't been around. It's not testable yet. Maybe if somebody proves it's never testable.
Oh, that's hard, too.
That's very hard.
Yeah.
So until you can prove it's never testable, you don't know that tomorrow you won't find a way to test it.
Right. Sure.
Well,
sure.
Yeah, I like this. There's a little tension in the room.
There is, but I'll tell you, it sells a lot of books, and I'm not going to do any math on it.
It is the Science Forum. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. Tell you what, let's take a short break, and then we'll get back for the home stretch, the last one-third of the program. Vox Pop on WAMC.
Support for Vox Pop comes from Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts. Family-owned business for over 50 years, offering lawn and garden equipment sales, parts, and service to customers throughout western Massachusetts. BoydenandPerrin.com. The Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working to permanently preserve the natural, scenic, and recreational resources of the Lake George region since 1988. LGLC.org. Snow Farm, Williamsburg, Massachusetts, a New England craft program offering creative arts workshops taught by master craftspeople for adults and teens, beginners and up. Snowfarm.org. And Kingsway Community, Schenectady, New York, offering a continuum of care and service to area seniors since 1975, including independent living, home care, assisted living, and more. Caring in the family tradition. 518-393-8800.
It's the Science Forum on WAMC. If you're scoring at home, that was Buddy Rich and his Roar of 74 with Tony Levin, local guy on the bass. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. And let's see now. Two is done. See, Christy, our call screener.
No more string theory.
Let's go to Lou in Schenectady. Lou, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I have two questions. One is mathematical and one is biological. The mathematical question is this. The Romans built all these sophisticated buildings, the Pantheon being one of the most sophisticated. And that, of course, implies that they had a facility with very complex mathematics. However, I don't see how they could do complex mathematics with a very cumbersome Roman numeral system. There seems to have needed to be a better way to do math than manipulating the complex Roman numerals. What kind of math did they use? And how did they do that?
They did geometry. They didn't necessarily have to do math to do geometry. There's a lot of geometry you can do without math.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And they were very good at geometry.
I see.
Well, actually, the Greeks were good at geometry, and the Romans stole from the Greeks.
But
they contracted the Greeks.
Things other than geometry, other than building things, other kinds of calculations that were not geometry?
Well, I think you're missing some point here, is that a number system is just a symbol that you use to indicate something that's in nature. And a number two, for example, doesn't mean anything outside of the symbology of the number two. So when you take 2 + 3 and it equals 5, you're doing the same thing as you would do in Roman numerals. They're just using a different system of writing to come up with the same thing. I think the Chinese had it right. I mean, the abacus is the way to go.
Uh-huh. And the second question I have is about woolly mammoths and mastodons. They're always shown in photographs and pictures in these very cold Arctic climates. Yet they're large beasts, and I suppose there wasn't much to eat in these areas. So how do they survive in these frigid climates where there was little nourishment?
Okay, that's good.
Just to clear it up, the photos of mastodons are actually not photos of mastodons.
Right, they had no cameras then.
Right.
There are, however, cave
of.
Paintings. Oh, that's true. That's true. It's an untestable theory. they tended to be on what would now be frozen and glacier-covered. But if you think of Greenland, Greenland isn't like a practical joke. It was green. Because of the way that the ocean currents flowed, it was relatively treeless. It had meadow, kind of what you would consider taiga now, and they ate the way reindeer eat.
Mm-hmm.
They were woolly, and they ate, and they had tusks.
And in places like Siberia, would that be the same kind of situation?
Well, I mean, it's all shifted since they've been, well, we killed them off, really, as far as we know. Again, we have some evidence that that is the case, but it was Homo sapiens that did in the mastodons, and they may have been a global climate change victim as well, but I'm sure the arrows and the feeding fests were more of an issue than global climate change.
Yeah, and where they live wouldn't have been ice covered all the time.
Right.
You know, in the summer months, things grew so they could eat then and then dig through the snow and get it in the wintertime.
And in temperate climates, you have so much more sunshine in the summer months that you get such massive amounts of growth. Even in the oceans, that's the most productive part of the oceans are the parts of the oceans that are the coldest and nearest the poles because it can grow so fast.
All right.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
Lou, thank you very much. We go to Mark in Nassau. Mark, you're on.
Hey, how are you? Thank you very much for this program. It's wonderful to hear so many smart people sharing their ideas, and I really, truly appreciate it. I have a kind of a dumb question here. Petroleum starts off as organic life of some sort that dies off and somehow gives us the gasoline we use to power everything. So my basic confusion is how is there that much accumulation of organic matter? And how come it pools? That is, why is it under Saudi Arabia and not under Brooklyn? Why is it under the Marcellus Shale and, not in the middle of Albany? So that's one question. And the second one has to do really with science and public relations.
Oh.
If science had to do it over again, how would they have sold global warming, climate change to a population that is reluctant to believe what doesn't directly impact it? That is, if 97% of scientists believe that that man is having an impact on the environment, and 50% of Americans don't believe it, it's kind of like scientists, let's use the analogy of ice. Water freezes at 32%, 99% of scientists believe that, but 50% of Americans don't. So what should scientists have done to really waken people up to the real impact?
All right, let's go to your first question first.
I'd ask, which one do you want answered? Because you
let's do the first one.
Okay, let's do the first question here.
I'm more interested in the politics, but the truth is, I would like to know more about petroleum.
Okay,
so
that's a great question. All right, let's do that.
Here's how the petroleum works. You start off with a continent. The continent breaks apart and water fills up the hole. Okay?
Okay.
Because it's a relatively narrow ocean that opens up, evaporation occurs relatively fast because water can't get in and out very fast, and you get a layer of salt.
Okay.
Also, as it opens up, rivers going into the ocean form deltas right in that environment.
Okay.
Deltas are places where you get a lot of deposition, and they happen to be places where you get lots of marshes. The marshes have the trees fall into the marsh, they get covered up by sand, and they get compacted.
Okay.
So you have all your organic material in a relatively local place. Now, when you open up an ocean, usually what happens is it opens up because there's a lot of heat underneath from the center of the earth that's coming up and moving the plates apart.
Okay.
So you got three things all at the same time. You've got a lot of organic material, you've got salt at the bottom, and you got heat. The sand okay. keeps on piling up. It gets heavier and heavier. The thing goes deeper and deeper into the ground. The salt, which is really light, starts to buoy up and forms what are called salt domes. And they make a trap to catch the oil. The heat heats up all the organic material, cooks it up real small, and that gets the oil moving as well. So the oil and the salt domes are intimately related. And that's why it all forms at the same spot. So it's all combined. It all happens because of the way plate tectonics works.
And I'm glad we haven't found too much oil under Brooklyn, because that would be a real scene if they...
Well, who knows?
Yeah. Hey, Mark, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551. James in Saratoga Springs. James, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I don't know if you can hear me okay. I'm on speakerphone.
So. Yeah, it's good.
And I wish I was more, I had a little bit more specific about what I'm actually asking. But on the news this morning, this is a current events question. On the news this morning, I heard a lot about this town, and I think it was in Iowa.
Wisconsin.
There you go. You're right. Wisconsin. There it is. And they're hearing these booming sounds coming from underground. They've ruled out seismic activity. They've ruled out all sorts of things. And I would love to get your guesses as to what this phenomenon could be. If it's not seismic activity, if it's not underground testing of explosives or whatnot, all the things that they've already ruled out. I'd love to get your opinion as to what you think and speculation as to what it might be.
Has anybody here seen these news reports?
No.
It's actually on our website. And it's a little town in Wisconsin, and people are being awakened in the middle of the night by these booms. They've been described as like a massive metal door being closed, and people will wake up in the middle of the night. Some have even said, they've watched the ground sort of move. The military has been contacted. They have nothing. The sewers have been checked. Nothing the city has found. No gas lines, anything like that. Nobody can really figure it out.
It's probably giant mutant moles.
Ah, well, now you have your answer, James.
What's interesting is that it's not just a handful of residents or even 12 or 15 or 20. Apparently, in this geographic area, there's, if I'm not mistaken, and I haven't looked on the website, at least 100 or more reports of this sound waking up residents at night and logging EMS calls.
I can tell you that the same thing happened in Denver a number of years ago, and what it turned out to be there was the U.S. Army doing nerve gas testing, which they weren't supposed to be doing, and they were pumping the water into the ground and not telling anybody. And what happened was the water was loosening up a series of faults that were down underground just enough to get them to start to go. And it was a newsman who was able to get the information from somebody.
Interesting.
And relate the two of them exactly, that every time there was a slight earthquake that caused this booming sound, it turned out to be the government pumping water into the ground.
Now, the only thing that what I would say would counteract that is that the seismologists in the region are not detecting, or at least saying they're detecting anything.
Well, it doesn't require a lot of movement of the ground. It doesn't have to be a fault movement. It could be just breaking of the earth.
James, thanks for bringing this one up, because I forgot
I'll
about
spend some
it,
time
frankly.
On it.
Now, you can have acoustic lenses in air where the general formation of air causes sound waves to sort of focus in one spot so you hear it. Is it possible to have geologic formations such that a very small motion in one place is going to be heard loudly in another?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It does happen. I'll look into it. I'll try and have an answer for you next time.
All right, good. Some homework. James, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go over to David in Wineskill. David, you're on Vox Pop.
Hi, I'll try to make this quick. I got two questions, but I'll just go with the first one. If you answer it quick, maybe the second one. With all the talk about the electric cars, I was just curious if everybody started using those, I mean a lot of people, would our grid be able to handle it?
It all depends if we start taking gas out of the Marcellus Shale. And since it's almost over, I can say that.
Oh.
Because right now, all our electricity, for most of it anyway, is being produced by natural gas. We don't have quite enough natural gas to go the route. But if we start getting more of it, yeah, we could handle it as far as the electric cars are concerned. I have an electric car. It takes very little energy.
Right. Okay. So
we're talking about two different things here.
I just want to be clear about something. My question has to do with the actual physical grid.
The grid, not the generation capacity. And the answer to that is if 50% of the people had cars in their garages, they could charge them at night. They could not charge them during the day. So with our current build-out, our current capacity, the current capacity carry electric current in the wires, you do have enough for every household, to 50% of the households to charge at night. So we could handle it right away.
What about in the summer when there's all that AC problem?
If you've got AC running all night, then you are going to have a problem, yes.
Okay. All right. The second question is, per unit of energy, and I don't know what you want to use, I don't know, BTU, per unit of energy delivered to a car, like, and when I say, I'm saying natural gas, starting with natural gas or oil versus the actual same amount of gasoline in a car, which one is actually more efficient to, like, how many miles per BTU? Would you get more miles per BTU via gasoline in a car, or would you get it via burning it?
If you burn it in a efficient steam combined cycle turbine, you can probably do between 2 and 4 times as many miles in an electric car as if that same number of BTUs went right into the gas tank.
And your emissions to the environment would be much less from the idea of acid rain producing and smog producing pollutant.
Excellent. You guys are great. Thank
except if the energy comes from a coal-fired power plant,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we were on natural gas. That's why we went right to natural gas, Ray.
Okay. See, and the batteries of electric cars is a great place to store renewable energy.
It's a lousy place to store renewable energy.
Oh, come on.
Next question.
You know, we got to make this show 2 hours again. 800-348, because we're just getting into the fights. Let's go to Jerry in Kerhonkson. Jerry.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for taking the call. The question has to go back to a few callers back, having to do with the theories of plate tectonics and continental drift. And I'm curious to know the opinions on how well grounded
So to speak.
Not so much plate tectonics, but continental drift. How well grounded is that theory? And has anyone heard of something called the expanding Earth theory?
That's Warren Carroll. Okay, as far as the plate tectonics is concerned, we've stuck things on the moon, we measure them, and we discover that the continents are moving. We have GPS, we can actually measure them that way, so we know that continental drift is occurring because we're measuring it. The fact that New York and Europe are separating at about 1.5 inches a year is probably one of the reasons why airline travel is becoming more expensive all the time. That's pretty well documented. What was the other part of that?
The expanding Earth.
Oh, the expanding Earth. S. Warren Carey from Australia said that if you shrink the Earth down, then you can get rid of the Pacific Ocean. The basic idea is that if you put the continents together in the Atlantic side, they all fit. If you shrink it down far enough, then the Pacific seems to close to some extent as well.
The Earth is actually expanding.
Right. So the Earth had a shell completely that is then that's gone by expanding. He never ever
just
tried to explain in his book how it could possibly have done that. So,
correct me if I'm wrong, but is there not a new theory having to do with the core of the Earth being a solid and not a metallic solid object and not molten?
It's always been a solid object.
The center
of the Earth?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Ever since we had very good seismographs, we've known that the center of the Earth has a big chunk of iron in it, or is it iron
and
nickel?
And rotating at a different speed than the planet rotates?
Yes, we have some evidence of that as well. Yep.
And now, that's what causes the Earth's magnetic field.
Right.
Okay.
Now, would not all that pressure from the center of the Earth need to find a way to work its way out?
It just balances gravity. That's what the whole sphere of the Earth is about.
How interesting. Okay. My next question had to do with the equinox that just passed. And if I'm correct, on the vernal and autumnal equinox, if we view where the sun is setting on the horizon, it's going to be due east or due west from any point where we are?
Yep.
So explain to me the effect it would have on the weather if we observed the equinox and saw the sun to be slightly north than where it should be on the equinox.
No effect whatsoever. It would have very little effect whatsoever. The point is the equinox is when the sun is lying right on the equator.
So I understand, and it splits the daylight and the nightlight and the nighttime
equal. Exactly.
12 and 12, and then as it travels towards its winter solstice.
Right. So the effect is minimal.
In the north, and summer solstice in the north. If there was some change in the orientation of the Earth and the Sun was not precisely on the equinox date, but slightly north of it.
By geometrical definition, in order to have equal days and nights, the Sun has to be exactly 90 degrees to the rotation axis. So that means directly east or west as we define it. So it's a tautology. The two, one defines the other. So you can't have one without the other.
I guess what I'm saying is that if the equinox is changing and it's not on the date that we think it is, and
right.
we've always thought it is, and is in the process
it moves.
It does move. We have leap years.
Jerry, I gotta say, I apologize, but we are completely out of time. You've opened up another avenue, and unfortunately, we can't go there right now. Thanks to Ed Stander and Barbara Brabitz and Ken Wells and Jim Pickett. Wonderful job. We will have you back again soon. Thanks to everybody who called in. Sorry if you didn't make it in. Support for WAMC comes from the Nature Conservancy's Adirondack chapter, working to protect ecologically important lands and waters of the Adirondacks for nature and people. nature.org/Adirondacks. Quality Foreign Car Care, Boston Spa, New York. Sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche. QFCC.com. At Adventure Outfitters, Hadley, Massachusetts, offering outdoor clothing, camping equipment, ice skates, cross-country skis, snowshoes, climbing equipment, canoes, and kayaks. Open evenings until 9. AdventureOutfitter.com. All right. Thanks to Christy Carton, who answered the phones, Zach Malloy, who handled the controls, our producer, Patrick Donges. Today's Thursday, right? That's tomorrow at this time. It'll be Moyers and Company. I'm Ray Graff. Have yourself a great weekend. Stay tuned now for a news update.